Found this in gunner room. Gunner mirror at me.
What is it?
Well, it's
sick performance.
Welcome to Synthaholics, guys. This is your host, David Duncan. And with me today is special guest...
Jeff. How you doing, David?
Doing good. How are you?
I'm great, thanks.
Jeff and I met last October at the Buffalo Comic Con. We had a table over there, and he was probably the most excited person to, like, stop by our table. It was really flattering.
I really... was very excited. I didn't really know what to expect from Buffalo Comic Con, that one being my first one. And so I went in, one of the very first comic book stands I stopped at, I bought like half a box of Star Trek comic books. And the guy's like, dude, did you know that there's like a Star Trek podcast here? And I'm like, where? And he immediately walked me over. And it was like right away, you know, I'm sure everyone that's listening to this understands when you meet other Star Trek fans, it's like, immediate camaraderie, family, community. It's like he started the talk and that was it. So yeah, it was great meeting you guys there. It was a lot of fun.
It was awesome. You had like, he also bought like a giant Excelsior ship, like toy model/thing. Yeah.
I was so excited, that being one of my favorite classes of ships, you know, and I thought, wow, this is too good to be true. And it was only like, I don't know, $50. And I think they retail for more. So I was like all excited. Yes. Love the Excelsior.
I almost bought that for the table because I wanted it to make it look like we're Star Trek. But I was like, oh, I bought these two figures. And they were kind of both kind of expensive. So I'm like, oh, I'm sure our big banner.
I would let you guys borrow it for the day. I mean, had I known that.
Oh, no. Well, you just picked it up. But it was just kind of like, yeah, I just wanted to like make my, you know, table look more Star Trek-y. And we had a giant banner.
Selfishly, I'm glad you didn't, because now I have it. But you did have a really slick phaser on the table. I do remember that.
Yeah. My prop from into the special edition of Star Trek in the Darkness, it was the replica of the phaser, and it's so pretty.
Yep, it was very nice. Very nice indeed.
This weekend was Star Trek Las Vegas. It's over now. It was pretty... Oh, it'll probably be last weekend by the time you hear this, but it was pretty amazing. It was 5 days. It was the first time that we got Whoopi Goldberg... and Christy Alley. It's the first time they've done a major Star Trek convention, or any Star Trek convention, I think.
Yeah, I saw that. I read some of what they had to say. I mean, it's really cool that for the 50th anniversary, of course, stars like that turn out. And, you know, the gratitude is just there. And I think, too, especially with, like, Christy Alley, I was reading with her, is that so much time has passed that you get, I think, a little bit more of an honest story behind, you know, why she didn't come back for the third movie and stuff like that. So you get kind of, I think, a little bit more given that it was the 50th anniversary. And Whoopi being there, of course, is super cool because she's, you know, still pretty widely known. I mean, my goodness.
Oh, sure. And the she even was saying, you know, I didn't read the entire thing, but she was saying she hopes she can come back in Brian Fuller's show. And like that could, if people are thinking it's pointing to a prequel because the registry number on the ship is so much smaller than, it's like, you know, NC-131, I think, or something like that. So it's smaller.
1031, I think. Yeah, like Halloween, I think, is what it is. But yeah, you're right. Absolutely. And it makes sense if it's, you know, Prime Universe, which I think they've already indicated it is.
They've confirmed it's Prime.
I know that Brian Fuller teased an image, I think, after. He didn't give much away, I think, during the actual 50th event in Vegas.
That's really disappointing because I was like calling or hoping that would be our first like real glimpse of anything.
But he did tease, I don't know if you saw this, like he teased like
it looks like Andorian antennas.
They're
a little bit more sleeker and longer than Andorian antennas, but I mean, like, it's artist interpretation. I mean, they could just be
watch it be not Andorian at all, although I mean, fingers crossed, it looks Andorian to me. So
I mean, maybe it's just the other sex of Andorians, because they have two males and two females. So maybe we've just seen like one kind of male Andorian. Maybe they're gonna differentiate the two different male, or maybe it's the second female type of Andorian. I don't know.
I think it's pretty cool, though, because given the comparison of all the Andorian antennae that we've seen over the years, you know, this is just the latest incarnation. They've kind of gone all over the place. So, yeah, but that was really cool to see kind of teased, you know, seeing actual work going on with this. It's so exciting. Such an exciting time.
Oh, sure. And you know, like, Brian Fuller did tease that, you know, actors could show up from other series in the new one. And if it's a prequel, I mean, the only one, you know, if it's prequel to TOS but sequel to Enterprise, I mean, the only people you could bring on would be Enterprise people.
I feel like T'Pol might be in our future.
I hope so. I really I really love T'Pol. And the thing is, Guinan, she could be there. She's an Elorian. She is she was there during the time of Mark Twain, as we saw.
Right, absolutely. So, shame, Mr. Clemens, shame. Absolutely. Yeah. The original shamer.
Yeah. So there's no reason other than, you know, and she's basically your get out of jail free card. Like, if they can't explain anything, just point the camera at Guinan, and then all is forgiven, I suppose, because that's what they used her for Next Generation. So, I mean, they could just keep on using it. Although I would prefer they flesh out who she is, what she is, and, you know, why that Q was kind of scared of her.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I mean, anytime someone stabs Q in the hand with a fork, I mean, that's just, that right there is amazing. So, yeah, let's hope we do get to see Whoopi again in the role of Guinan, because I agree, that would be awesome. And there are so many ways they could go with her, like you said, given that time really is a different thing for her altogether than most of our characters. So, yeah.
They live longer than Vulcans. I mean, hundreds and hundreds of years instead of just maybe 200 or 300 years, so...
Right. Yep. Absolutely. Elorians. Let's see if they show up.
Yeah. Maybe get Malcolm McDowell back.
Oh. maybe not.
You don't want Malcolm McDowell back?
To be fair, I think he looks the same, so it would be not much of a stretch, you know, to bring the character back. But you know, that would be pretty sweet to see, like a little shout out to another Elorian.
I would just personally love to see him. I feel so sorry for him nowadays because I hear his just illustrious, amazing voice in like really dumb commercials, like like pizza rolls or something, like little like warm up snacks for kids. Like, they're awful commercials, and you've got like this beautiful voice coming through, and it's Malcolm. You cannot mistake his voice.
So have you seen, the actress, I think is it Jennifer Hetrick or something like that played Vosh, and she's in like, commercials for like, I think it was maybe Geico or something like that. I mean, to be fair though, at least they're working. You know what I mean? They gotta pay the bills. It's just the same as everybody else. So, you know,
no doubt. I'm not disparaging him right. for doing these commercials because you have to pay the bills, but right. I'm just like, he's an amazing actor. Give him like actual roles, not just commercials. So I would just be so happy to see him show up, you know, as that character again, just to get him back on screen, like, you know, let him do what he's born to do, be an amazing actor.
Maybe as like an act of redemption on his part too, because I mean, he is kind of a maligned villain in the whole, you know, lexicon, given that he killed Kirk, and it really wasn't the, I think, you know, ultimate death that people were hoping for. So maybe he could come back as this even worse villain, or maybe he could be a good guy. And we really
I think he should come. Yeah. I think he should be a good guy, because I'm pretty sure, like, when he was talking to Picard, he's just like, you know, I used to be like you, you know. So right. like it would be nice to see like maybe a good Sauron, mm-hmm. or maybe see why he turned, you know. What turned him? I mean, who knows?
Well, I know we're not here to talk about the new series, but that 31, you know, they've kind of, I think Brian Fuller mentioned that there is a clue in the registry. So that 1031, of course, means Halloween. It also means possibly Section 31. It's a date, you know, so there's a few different ways you can interpret. Of course, at this point, everything is being interpreted many ways. But, you know, so, yeah, we'll see if maybe Section 31 has some sort of an involvement in what we see with the new series as well.
I can only hope so, because I would just love like it to be a small little thread, then it turn out to be something huge, you know, like season finale to go into the next season.
Which maybe they even jump forward in time. I mean, I will see. I mean, right now imagination just can run rampant.
Anything to get away from that ship. I hate the way that ship looks.
No, isn't it based off of, was his name
Ralph?
Ralph McQuarrie.
Ralph McQuarrie. Yeah, like his original concept for like Star Trek: Planet of
Titans. I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, hey, if he's getting at least this many years later a little bit of a shout out by his ship design being featured in something other than like a junkyard in TNG, or you know something to that effect, or in the Earth Space Dock in Star Trek III. I mean, hey. Good for him, but I'm going to side with you on this. I would prefer for a little more, I guess, elegant design. Of course, that's relative, but...
Well, I mean, like, something with curves on it, other than the saucer. The saucer looked great, and then they cut away to the rest of it, those really boxy nacelles and the really boxy, you know, secondary hull. I'm just like, this...
I love
it. Star Trek has a very specific, or especially for the Federation, they have a very specific design aesthetic.
That's true.
You can look at a Federation ship and they're all look like Federation ships. This does not look like a Federation ship.
But could that mean something greater that's going on in the story?
I mean, they could be taking cues from Star Trek Beyond, or not Beyond, Star Trek in the Darkness, and like they're being built like kind of in secret, like inside that thing. Maybe it is specifically a Section 31 ship.
If the design is reflective of another, you know, race that we've seen, I mean, it's so boxy. I mean, aside from like, the obvious Star Wars comparisons of those, you know, ships that are in there, the triangular ones. What are they called again?
Star Destroyers.
That's the one. But that comparison aside, it's the Klingon potential for design influence that, you know, maybe is there somewhere. I mean, it's a time that we don't really know too terribly much about. So we'll see how that sort of informs, you know, what the actual design of the ship is. But I love how I say elegant, you say curvy. <That's awesome. laughs> We need more curves.
It needs more curves. And like, you know, we actually talked about this in the last episode that we did, and they were saying that the Enterprise D looked like a, you know, a girly vessel because it just had so many curves. It didn't look dangerous at all.
Kind of like a big girl, though. I mean, my goodness. It's like a giant ship.
It's huge, and like it's got the giant oval, and like the way the neck is formed, it's got that, it's thin and it curves out. It's such a bizarre design, but it's beautiful.
I always loved the galaxy design. I think that they kind of did an injustice to the overall design lineage when the Sovereign came out. I mean, and I know this is a hot debate amongst, you know, the ship fans that are out there, that the Sovereign actually was a better design, sleeker and all that. But to me, there was something lost when the Galaxy class, which was always seen kind of on its own, it's this massive, massive ship. And then you see this sort of stretched out kind of, you know, super fast looking. I will definitely give it that, but it just lacked the majesty.
It doesn't look iterative.
Yes.
That's my problem with it. Cause I mean, they did the Excelsior and then they did the Enterprise D. Oh, the Enterprise B was an Excelsior class. And then for Yesterday's Enterprise
Ambassador class,
they had the Enterprise C come out, yep. And that looked like it could have really been like an in-between.
Right.
Like, you know, in time period. Sovereign class, just like, it looks more like the Voyager. It looks more like they redesigned a Voyager class rather than, you know what I mean? It's got the elongated primary hull. It's got no neck.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's clearly designed for the sleek kind of fast look, I think. But I mean, again, we could probably have like three episodes alone on discussing Enterprise design lineage and Starship looks and appearances and all that. But
and it's
a great topic.
Never done.
Everybody has their favorites and the ones that they always root for. But personally, I always love the Galaxy class. So, you know, my thing.
I do love the Galaxy class. I mean, I don't mind the Sovereign class. It just doesn't seem iterative to me.
Mm-hmm.
I agree. Today, we are here to talk about Balance of Terror.
Absolutely.
Because when we talked about you coming on the show, you were saying that was the episode that you would want to talk about.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, to me, it's first season of the original series goodness. I mean, it's an iconic episode that has a lot of iconic moments, you know, and I'll try not to overuse that word or overstate that word for this discussion, but I mean, Balance of Terror, there are so many firsts in it. And it's also just an overall great episode. It typically makes, you know, the top 10 lists or at least top 20 lists that fans would, you know, recite. But it's just a great episode. So, yeah, absolutely. I was happy that I could pick it. I thought for sure somebody would have already scooped this one up and you guys, you know, would have talked about it. But looks like I'm the first one. So that's awesome.
Yes. Yes, indeed. We were very first. I mean, we've probably only covered like a handful of TOS episodes in the little, like, almost a year and a half we've been out, like, probably, like, 6 or 7 TOS episodes.
Right.
So not that many. I mean,
this is like a big one.
There's 700-something episodes of Star Trek, so it's just, like...
Okay. Understandable, but this was one that, I mean, it's just got so many cool things about it. You know, and just the way that, again, first season, we're introduced to the Romulans, cloaking device, you know, Mark Leonard, we see the Enterprise in real battle stations mode. It's just an episode that, you know, it sets precedents that go beyond most episodes that you'll watch, you know, and that's really cool when you're especially celebrating the 50th anniversary. You take a look back at this and all of the effects that this, you know, kind of one episode started. And then, you know, you could even talk about ways that it hasn't really properly been, I guess, sequelized, if that makes sense. And I know that there are video games and there are books and all of that have kind of touched upon this. But one thing I always kind of wanted to see was like a sequel to this. It's interesting if they had done a sequel to this episode instead of like The Wrath of Khan, not that I'm knocking it in any way, but, you know, the first season had another opportunity with an enemy that was killed that could have had family, could have had connections, that we could have seen more out of the Romulans and their response to this, but never did. But yeah, it's a great episode. I think you said you rewatched it today, right?
I did. And the going with what you were just saying, though, a sequel to this, technically, according to Memory Alpha, there kind of is. In a novel, William Shatner's novel, actually, The Return, Kirk is resurrected by a Borg-Romulan alliance to kill Captain Jean-Luc Picard. The Romulan alliance was arranged by the granddaughter of the Romulan commander of this mission.
Right, which,
so,
again,
like, that's kind of bonkers.
So the books, I get the books, and, you know, I may have actually read that one, to be honest, but, you know, from a series or movie perspective, I mean, this was really an opportunity, and good for the writers of the books and Bill Shatner for seeing, wow, this is one that we missed out on for, you know, possible sequel, and they took advantage of it. But I always thought that they could have done a little bit more with this. But it'd be a little more difficult, I think, given that, you know, Mark Leonard comes back, Larry Montaigne, he comes back as well as Vulcans in the same episode. So it's sort of like we see them again, just in totally different roles.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. You know, I love how the Romulans look in this. I like their clothes aesthetic. I don't mind that they've got helmets to try to cover up the ears.
Yep.
Their ship design was kind of cool.
Yep.
It was, I mean, given what they had to work with, I mean, it was still kind of a pretty basic design, but it still looked kind of neat. And the nacelles are very, I mean, I guess they weren't trying to make things look too different. I mean, the D7s looked very different, but, The nacelles looked very reminiscent of, like, the Enterprises. So it was almost kind of like people were saying that maybe, you know, Romulans stole technology from Earth.
Right. And I think that's actually a cut line. I'm pretty sure it was in the script. I'm not sure if they actually filmed it. But when they encounter, you know, going into the episode, when they encounter, of course, at Outpost 4, Commander Hansen, and he mentions, you have to warn Earth that they've stolen our ship designs. And I think that, you know, if you think about production of these episodes back then, especially the first season, keep in mind that when this one was produced, Star Trek hadn't even aired yet, right? So
sure, yeah,
the music, the lighting, everything in it, the model making, they had nothing to base this on other than the scripts. And so Wah-Chang probably got a very early script. Wah-Chang is the guy that, you know, famous sculptor, of course, that did the model. He probably got a very early version of the script, read that line, probably one of the only clues, you know, aside from like the bird painted underneath as to what it might look like.
Sure, yeah.
And that's probably why he modeled it to look so similar to, you know, what would then be a Starfleet design, right? And of course, that's dropped in the episode. But I mean, that's a great point that you raise of the similarities.
Well, also, it just, I mean, like, maybe the Romulans were on tougher times after that 100-year war, but Next Generation, in a very similar episode, where, like, you know, they're causing trouble in the neutral zone, and it's a very different ship, and it's like, they're so proud that they designed the ship all on their own.
Oh, yeah, I mean, the Derridex class, that's like, when you compare the two, it's like, oh my goodness, obviously there was some sort of technological boom in the Romulan technology development, but
Were they harnessed miniature black holes? Is there?
Warp. Clearly, we had advanced our understanding of, you know, how these things could actually work, you know, between the 60s, certainly, and what we thought the audience could handle of, you know, the late 80s into the 90s. But, yeah, I mean, I think that the ship design of that of the Romulan ship, again, iconic. I mean, everyone sees that ship, and kind of like the, I mean, I think the D7, the Klingon ship, is a bit more popular. But still, for the original series, given that this was one of what, like, three models, I think, or four models that was built for like the entire original series. It's
Enterprise, an K7, the D7, the Romulan ship. Oh, and then we had Botany Bay.
Botany Bay, right? I was just going to say,
and then lots of other versions of a Constitution class ship.
Right. Yeah. Different screenshots of it, but yeah. So it is iconic because it's been seen so many times. One cool thing too, and I don't know if you read this too about the model, is that it was mysteriously lost, and they really don't know what happened to the actual filming model. There's like a story where, because Hua Cheng, of course, the builder, he wasn't under contract properly. He actually had to get the ship given back to him, and there's a rumor that he kind of like smashed it in his backyard out of anger. Rage. But then there's another rumor that
Gene Roddenberry didn't have a habit of making people unhappy.
No, not at all. This guy had no reason to be upset. I'm sure he was well paid, but. But then the other rumor, of course, is that I think it was in the early 90s when the Smithsonian was given the Enterprise model. The Romulan ship at that time, it was said the owner of it was not willing to let it be borrowed. So, you know, it's a mystery. It could be in someone's garage right now. We have no idea. You know, it's one of those missing kind of myths.
Star Trek lore, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Really cool stuff.
Well, I mean, they had lots of beautiful ships hanging in the Star Trek Experience in Las Vegas that they shut down right before the 2009 movie opened up. And from what I understand, most, if not all, of those beautiful models that were hanging from the ceiling of that event were destroyed.
Oh, really? So they didn't sell most of them?
I think they might have auctioned parts of them off, but I think, yeah, like, just the process of getting them down probably damaged them.
Oh, man.
And the bridge set they threw out, and I want to say they're restoring the Enterprise D bridge. I think they got yes, parts of that, and they're trying to restore it to make it look like the original Enterprise D and not like the Experience, because the Experience looks close, but it wasn't exactly, because I mean the you as the audience, you only kind of walked up back where Worf walked, and then straight onto the turbo lift, which the turbo lift was also giant compared to what it was in the show, because it had to fit like 30 people.
Right, yeah, everyone come up and walk.
Because it's a ride.
Right. No, that's too bad. I didn't know that about the models, but geez, that's too bad. Hopefully it's just a rumor and they're actually, you know, safe somewhere. Hopefully we'll see them again. But yeah, the episode, again, Balance of Terror, first season stuff, which is, to me, I'm a huge fan of that time, because there are still sort of things that they're working on from a character development perspective. You know, the uniforms are still kind of, they're playing around with those a little bit still.
They call them torpedoes, phasers.
Well, yeah, exactly. the proximity detonation, you know, and of course the episode, just a quick shout out there to Paul Schneider, or Scheider rather, who wrote it, who oddly enough wrote for Mr. Magoo, which is hilarious. Like the blind guy in the cartoons, like,
yeah.
Crazy that he, you know, wrote this and also for that. It's like I never made that connection until I read it, but you know, really, really a story that was sort of adapted after a submarine versus a destroyer movie, and I think it was called The Enemy Below.
Actually two movies that they drew plot points from or were inspired by. One was The Enemy Below, and I'm looking up what the other one was right now. The other one was Silent, Run Deep.
Right. And I think that, you know, for the first time that we see the phasers that would then later become photon torpedoes, I don't think they had yet developed the term photon torpedo, and they hadn't
until Arena.
Yeah, right. So it's still it's proximity detonation or something like that of the phasers. Of course, they reuse that same effect then for the torpedoes later on. But yeah, I mean, everything from that terminology to the cloaking device, of course, which was meant to really save costs because they weren't then showing this model over and over again in effect shots.
Yeah, they're just showing like the explosions clip over and over and over and over again.
Right. But no visual communication with them previously. I mean, the show was really written to sort of augment that notion of
a submarine battle.
Right, exactly, yeah. Exactly. And so, I mean, there is sort of an excitement there. Same thing with, like, even the firing of the phasers, torpedoes, the phasers of the Enterprise, where it's Kirk telling Stiles at the navigation station, and then he's telling this room that I think we see maybe once before, if ever again. And they're down in this control room and they're firing these things. I mean, it was just totally not something you'd learn to become accustomed to. It was usually just fire the phasers and, you know, Sulu or Chekhov are pressing a button and there they are.
There they are, yeah.
Right.
It's just written, you know, just they're trying to evoke a different feeling, I guess, with this episode. Then it's like, oh, it's the future. They don't have to, like, do all that stuff because, like, maybe they learned. Let's you know, rig it to the bridge instead of down where they can have, you know, phaser coolant links.
Right.
Which, dangerous pink gas.
Which, of course, would come back to haunt other very famous Starfleet vessels later on. But, you know, that's another episode, I'm sure.
Sure. But speaking of, like, the detonation of the phasers, like, where they just kind of shoot them out and then detonate them, blow them up. Like, I finally got to see Star Trek Beyond a second time. I'm like, why didn't you just... They're like, oh, the torpedoes can't lock on anything. Just detonate them. It's a matter, antimatter explosion. You ought to take out a couple of them.
Right. Something. It's bound to hit something.
If you know? Just, you don't have to hit, you don't have to target anything. Just shoot it into the swarm, blow, detonate it.
You know, and I think the only other time that I can think of where they really articulated that notion in a movie, or even really a show, but certainly a movie, if you remember in Nemesis, I mean, when the ship just sort of shot and all, it was like cover fire, like all over the place. You'd never really seen that before, at least, you know, often. And I thought, to me, that was like a modern day version of what they were trying to do in Balance of Terror with the proximity detonations, or at least hoping to hit something, you know?
Yeah, just doing a wide sweep just to hope, you know, they can, you know, figure out where it is.
Right, absolutely.
Although they could have just rigged the torpedoes to look for gas.
Well, they hadn't been developed yet, so no. It's got to have a tailpipe, right? Which was used, actually, I think, to, you know, shoot debris out of a few times. But, yeah, anyway.
Yeah, they did. Like, the Romulans are really, really kind of smart. They were just like, throw the dead people. Throw the debris out. Maybe they'll think we're, you know, dead.
Right. The poor Centurion. You know. what a send-off.
I'm sorry, my old friend.
Right.
I need to get home.
The themes of the episode, though, I thought were really cool. I mean, there's bigotry that gets addressed in that. I mean, with Stiles and his family history. And I mean, certainly for the time, I mean, the 60s, that was just a huge, huge thing that we as a country and as a world were grappling with. And, you know, you get to kind of see that played out where, you know, wow, uh-oh, we finally established visual communications with these, you know, sworn enemies of 100 years, 100 plus years, and wow, they actually look
like Vulcans.
Just like the Vulcans. Oh my goodness, you know, and it's
and
like,
I wish they would have stayed that way.
Yeah. So I know what you mean, like in TNG when they kind of added those ridges.
Well, the thing is, the helmets of the guys who didn't have the ears, like, it gave them that ridged head look, because I was just looking at them. I'm like, okay, I can see maybe where they got the ridged head from. Maybe they wore those helmets so long, it put a permanent frown on them, and that was just genetic. But it just, I don't know, it just, they didn't need the headpiece. It just, they were supposed to look just like Vulcans, and then they made them look different than Vulcans. And I'm like, why? You're saying we're dumber now?
Well, and you wonder, would it have been as effective as a reveal if they had included that back then? Of course, you know, definitely a different situation. I mean, the reason why they were wearing the helmets is the budgetary constraints. Again, they didn't have enough money to pay for the ears.
It's also why we saw the Klingons show up a lot more than the Romulans, because the Klingons are cheaper to do because they just had, like, dark makeup and big hair.
Right,
or
yep.
big mustache.
And, yes, exactly. Lots and lots of dark makeup.
Lots and lots of dark makeup. And, like, this one episode, the one with Kang, like, they run out of makeup, and the Klingons get progressively lighter skinned as the episode goes on.
Well, and imagine, too, there was a lot of, like, physical action in that. Like, imagine, like, a day like today, under lights, because you know those lights entered the original series, and certainly this this episode is no exception. Balance of Terror is beautifully lit, but imagine having that dark makeup on or a helmet, and you know, doing all those action sequences. I mean, that could not have felt, or I suspect smelled, very good by the end of the day.
Oh no, it was awful. And like, you know, these are the Voyages books that detail the original series like in minute detail. Like, it was just, it was a bad set anyway. They were kind of like in the back and no one really cared about them. And I think if they flushed the toilet, the lights would flicker. I mean,
oh my goodness.
Like, just like, it was just awful. Like,
if only they knew, and you know, I suspect maybe some of them had an idea, but if only they knew what they were kind of becoming a part of, it might have felt a bit different for them. Although, you know, everything's 2020 in hindsight, I guess, right?
Oh, definitely. Definitely. It's just, it's,
but another theme too that I thought was really cool in this episode as well. I mean, you're 60s, right? So Demilitarized Zone, also known as the neutral zone here of the North and South Vietnam. I mean, they borrowed elements into this story right from what was then current day, you know, and Starfleet's directive really to the Enterprise. Of course, there's a distance gap there where communication isn't immediate or real time. It seems telling them that the ship is pretty much expendable and you are not to start an intergalactic war, you know, in any way, shape or form, only defend yourself. And that's about it, which is interesting because this is, again, I think one of the earlier times where we see a James Kirk who, you know, not only does he have that great scene with Dr. McCoy, where he really starts to question, you know, why him and why does he have all this responsibility and the weight of command? And then, you know, of course, McCoy, the ship's doctor, also, I guess, counselor slash bartender, you know, inspires him that he can do this, you know, and he absolutely can be a tactician and make calls. And then we get to see that right all in this episode. And that's yeah, the Captain Kirk that we'd all get to know, right?
Oh yeah. And it's just a beautiful scene, like where he's just like, you know, there's a billion, you know, it was like a billion million galaxies and the, you know, there's, you know, so many inhabitable planets in each of these galaxies. And there's only one of each of us.
Yeah.
Don't kill the one named Jim Kirk.
Well, and I love too, that they kind of had the cage kind of did that scene. And so they were able to, between Christopher Pike and Dr. Boyce, and then they were able to perfect it, of course, in this episode between, you know, Kirk and McCoy. But yeah, it's
this scene was much, much better than the one in the cage.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, the one in the cage, I felt like it kind of dragged on to me a little bit. It was just kind of awkward, and especially, I mean, it may have just been because you didn't really know the characters, and they're right, just like dumping like tons of exposition on you because this is the first time you've ever seen anything like this ever.
Right.
And then by the time it's recast and, you know, it's Kirk instead of Pike and all that other stuff, like, I feel like they were a little bit less heavy-handed with like just the interpersonal dialogue, and it was a little bit more sparse, so this had a lot more meaning, I think.
Yeah, and we knew, I think too, that this was their interpretation of the characters they were playing, and it's, again, very early on, and so you're starting to see that kind of play out, and we get to know these people, and this scene is just instrumental in understanding who they are as, you know, as a captain and what he relies on McCoy for, you know, and that's awesome. And we even get to see, so in the opening, you know, when you're talking about how the outposts are being attacked, you know, and it's just an excitement sort of on the bridge. You get to see these people performing their jobs in a sort of a different situation than we get to see, or have seen up until this point. Which, you know, again, is really cool to see, or early Trek for sure.
Oh yeah, definitely. And then speaking of like people doing what they're supposed to be doing, like at the beginning when they call the alarm and everyone's running out, there's just so many people in the hallways. It makes it feel like this is a living, breathing place that like stuff has to happen when stuff, you know, when battle stations is called.
Yeah, and we're introduced as well to sort of like junior crewmen. I mean, that's another thing that later on in the series, I feel like they kind of got away from. I know that there were like later episodes, especially season three, where you know, Gene would reach back out and say, "Where are all the extras? Where are all the people?" And it was totally because of budget costs. But you know, this is definitely one where you're right. We do see that the ship is just, you know, filled with young officers all over the place. And that's, yeah, cool to see.
Yeah, but I mean, even in the later series, like, I guess they did a little bit of job having extras more consistently, but But still, even though it's still usually just your main cast and no one else has ever really heard from, unless there's a guest star for that episode where they kind of have like the limelight for that one episode, then never see them again.
Right. No, absolutely. With this, too, in the beginning, we are, I think this is the first episode where we kind of get the understanding that there are outposts, you know, so there are kind of other, the Starfleet, obviously, and the Federation, Starfleet especially, is this organization that, you know, has stationed people all over. And, you know, so we see this Commander Hansen, and geez, he's had better days at Outpost 4. But, I mean, this is still very early on, so his uniform, while obviously Starfleet, at least it looks like a Starfleet uniform at the time, it's interesting to note, no rank indicator, but his badge, this is still in the time when they were giving different, I guess, mission-specific or at least assignment-specific patches. And, you know, you see that. You have to look for it. It's much easier to see in, I suspect, the remastered. But that was one thing that I thought was really cool. And that badge, actually, it's reused in Arena. So apparently if you're in some very bad assignment on an outpost, be prepared to... Be prepared to be.
If you're on the fringes, you get like the turd shaped insignia.
Yes, exactly. And it's already probably come, it comes with like the battle wear on it, you know, but just to make it easier on you. But that same badge is worn, actually, if you watch Mirror Mirror, Dr. McCoy in the Mirror Universe, his uniform has that same badge. I think it's arranged a little differently, but it's there. I read that and I was like, oh, little stuff like that. I love it. It's super cool.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Those little details here and there.
Yeah, definitely.
Like I heard they had to take they had to unstitch the badge every single time they washed it because it would destroy the badge if they washed it with a badge on. So I think that's why in like Enemy Within, like one of the first early in the episode, like Kirk doesn't even have the badge on.
And what kind of director are you for not noticing? I mean, again, you're talking early days. It's like they probably had directors that didn't even really understand that's a critical thing, you know, and that's why it slipped by. But yeah, very, very different time in the production of the series.
Oh, sure, sure. And I mean, I've heard people say that, you know, Yeoman Rand and Kirk were never supposed to be really involved, but like, it always seemed like they were supposed to be pretty involved. Like she's all like when they think they're going to get hit.
Right.
She's like, you know, snuggling up to his back, and then it's like they embrace a little bit right before they get hit with the beam. You know, it's like, that's not normal. Well, that's not a normal, like, officer co-officer relationship.
And I'm sorry.
Unless there's something else going on.
Any woman that is busting out a hand phaser to warm up coffee for you while you're working and your friends up on the bridge, I mean, what do you think? We're not going to notice this? Come on. Janice, come on. Like, obviously, she's got a thing for the captain. And, you know, it's kind of cool that she's still a part of the series at this point, and we get to kind of see her in it. But yeah, I mean, that's...
Yeah, she was only in 6 episodes, but then we got her back in the movies.
Right.
A couple of them.
Yep, absolutely. But then I think, too, Mark Leonard's performance in this was just awesome.
It was beautiful.
Yeah, and you're really given, and this is partly, I think, why I love the idea of there, you know, being some sort of a sequel to it that we actually got to see. Because, I mean, he's obviously a character of integrity, and you understand, you know, why he's doing what he's doing. He even questions it, you know, and it's not like what we would eventually see so often in the original series with the Klingons, which, you know, very rarely, maybe with the exception of Kang, you know, did they get to a point where they were more than just a villain, you know? And I feel like that's the best kind of villain. It's always made the best kind of villains, really, and especially in Star Trek when you understand the perspectives. And it was like another hero just on the wrong side, really.
Yeah,
and
I feel like the Romulans definitely have more honor than Klingons. For as much as Klingons spout honor and honor this and honor that, like, it just doesn't...
Well, it's interesting that you say that. No, that's a great topic, actually, because you're right. I think that when the Romulans were conceived, it was Roman, obviously, influenced.
Yes.
There was a great deal of honor, I think, in this Romulan commander. But, you know, the other thing I think that was inspired probably by the cloaking device, which I think isn't even called a cloaking device yet. It's an invisibility field. But the fact that they're kind of lurking around, it feeds into that Roman treachery and subsequently Romulan treachery that we would then come to learn, of course, and expect, you know, out of the Romulans as a race. But yeah, I mean, I think that they had, if you think about the story here, they're sort of testing the metal of this enemy that they haven't really seen or had contact with in 100 years. You know, and was it a dishonorable thing to do? Maybe. I guess it depends on the side that you're looking at this from, right? So that really is a compelling, you know, perspective when it comes to the Romulans initially being with more honor than the Klingons. Now, certainly don't tell that to Worf because he'd probably beat us. But I absolutely agree. I mean, I mean, his character in particular.
Klingons are just so, like, genuinely dishonest. I mean, they both have cloaking devices. Romulans and the Klingons both have cloaking devices. So Klingons can't stand on that higher ground. And just Klingons are just so, like, they don't think about things. I think in order to be honorable, you've got to be able to think things through and, like, not make rash decisions. And Klingons just make rash decisions.
Well, I think Klingons became known as more honorable the more we got to know them. You know, I mean, if you just took a look at the original series alone and then, you know,
I don't think they talked about it so much in the original series.
No. I agree with that. I mean, in the original series, they were basically the Soviets.
Yeah.
I don't really, you know, I mean, what else could we really call them? But you're right. I don't think that honor, I think they were portrayed as dishonorable, frankly, but
sure. Yeah.
Yeah, so I think they became more honorable later on, which is interesting.
They started throwing the word around later on.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. All about honor. And that's Worf, I think, largely. And then we see it certainly as we are introduced to their greater culture,
you know,
more.
Bartok and,
right, you know, Gowron and the rest.
Yeah, they all say honor every other word. And I'm like, you keep saying that word, and I'm not sure you know what that word means.
Right.
Not sure.
By actions, anyway. Right. Absolutely. But again, back to the episode. One thing that a scene that I thought was really cool, still again, very early Trek, is the conference that they have with the senior staff, and where Spock breaks the protective shield, or you know, I think did he call it titanium or dibernium or something like that? I don't remember. I'm sure someone out there knows exactly what it was. But
well, like in the Star Trek Catan board game, tritanium is the metal object, so maybe it's tritanium. I don't remember from watching the episode, but tritanium.
But when he breaks it, it's just such a great dramatic spectacle because everyone's just like, "Oh my gosh!" You know, at
this
table.
Is like the hardest substance we know of, and she just cracks in his hand.
Right.
Vulcans are strong. What are you benching?
Right. Meanwhile, Uhura, I think, just takes a sip of her coffee and is like, "That's great."
She's like, "Yeah, I know how strong you are. I've seen."
Right. And I think, too, when they made mention of, was this where they talked about the comet that was sort of coming? And is this where Spock kind of like pushed away the book, didn't need it, and kind of like knew that this was coming? Or
yeah.
Awesome stuff. I mean, like things like that where you're really laying the foundations of Spock down. It's like, oh, my gosh, super cool.
Although,
for sure.
I don't know why they made him clumsy.
Clumsy.
Yeah, when he's like underneath the computer and he like puts his hand up when they're in like silent mode and they're waiting for the Romulans to make a move. And
right,
he like presses a button. I'm like, those are giant buttons. Wouldn't you feel that before you like, you know, press down on it?
Well, and it's just like you kind of were expecting, like, did he and Kirk have some little like plan going on that nobody else knew? And like, he did that on purpose so that the Romulan would be baited and they'd be able to do this. I mean, they never really explicitly said that, but it would have been kind of, you know, you're right. Clumsiness isn't something that Vulcans are known for.
But it just, I mean, it was there because, you know, to give Stiles fuel for his racist fire.
Right. Exactly.
But at the same time, like, yes, it's there for his racist fuel fire, but, like, Spock shouldn't be clumsy. Like, he legitimately had a Jar Jar moment where he pressed a button he wasn't supposed to press.
I think that's why I'd like to think that there was some greater plan at work that wasn't necessarily shared with the audience.
or Stiles.
Or Stiles. Certainly not Stiles. I mean, because it really wouldn't have meant nearly as much when Spock sort of saves him from the dangerous pink gas, a.k.a. leak. If you know, none of this had happened, you know, so it's all in the setting, I guess. But I mean, again,
like the Joker from this 1960s Batman, like, you know, put his like flower gas in there.
Oh, gosh. Right. Exactly. Cesar Romero is, like, somewhere in the back squeezing out, like, all this.
Yeah. He's like, man, my flower's too small. I've got a giant vat back here. I've just got to keep pumping it.
It's leaking from our set into the other one. We'll make use of it in both ways. But, no, that's awesome.
Next door sets.
Right. I think they actually were. Believe it or not, I feel like I've read that elsewhere, that the sets were actually really nearby, which, if you think about it, they did exchange sort of extras and cast members enough that it's not really surprising to hear that. But anyway, again, back to the episode, one thing that I thought was really cool about this episode that you don't really get to see often, I think we see it maybe in one or two other episodes, where they actually get Uhura to come up to the nav console.
Oh, I love that.
Yes, anytime that they give Nichelle Nichols something more to do other than, you know, hailing frequencies open or sitting in the background looking dismayed is so awesome. And, like, she works it, like, best she can.
And she's so literally very confident. And, like, I don't know what they did for the lighting there. I don't remember them ever using lighting like that. Like, it looked very unique for
first season TOS. Lighting, I'm telling you, it's like movie quality in some spaces.
That must have been, like, painful to sit under, but it looked gorgeous. Like, the right. light on her specifically, because she was in the foreground a lot of those shots.
And
like,
she, I think really at the good. End, at the end when she actually, you know, fires off or is, well, you know, sends the message to have the shot fired properly, but when, you know, the Romulan ship has been disabled and she just sort of, she's got her arm kind of like pushed back, and she's just like, yep, I did that.
Yeah.
And it's just awesome. You don't see that, really, that kind of style or swagger from anybody else.
No.
So that was really cool.
It's just a testament to how amazing she, you know, Nichelle Nichols is.
Right. Oh, my God, yeah. Absolutely. So that's one of the cool little things. And a lot of people forget about, but when you see that episode and she's there, it's like, oh, my God,
it's like,
yes.
It's like, too bad she didn't do a fan dance in the 60s. Right?
yes. No. Yeah. A little later on, she did, but then she
actually did a fan dance when she was 60. So, you know,
and still could get away with it. I mean, hey.
She's definitely still a good looking woman, but it's just that
back then it was just
weird. You know, it's just like, hey, let's undress our only female officer and have her dance for sand people, and then we'll surprise them instead of just surprising them by sneaking up on them.
Hey, it worked.
Did.
You know, I mean, what can I say? Good for Uhura. She comes through for us every time. But again, the ending of the episode, which, you know, I think is amazing as well, because you're actually sort of given this honorable send off to an enemy, and they understand, you know, that the two captains understand, I think, each other. And the episode is great too, because it sort of peppers throughout.
They
almost compliment
each other. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, the respect and sort of, wow, I think he calls him a sorcerer at one point.
I mean,
and that's, I mean, I guess to the discredit of the Romulans, they have such great use of English. They clearly learned that during the two-way radio discussions that they had with Earth. But it's, you know, looking past that, it's just really cool that the dialogue really gives off this mutual respect. You know, and in the end, he does kind of do the honorable thing and self-destructs the ship. So. That, you know, and then just when you think that the ending couldn't get any sadder, of course, we learn that the only casualty
is the one who's going to get married.
Is the dude that was about to get married, and he isn't even wearing a red shirt. It's like,
nope.
Oh man, it's like salt in the wound. And then his poor fiance, you know, Angela Martin.
He was like hugging the conduit that was spewing the yellow gas, the pink gas. He was like hugging it because, like, when Spock comes in and saves Stiles and shoots the torpedo off, or phaser, quote unquote, he's like lying there, like right next to it. Like, man, you must have been huffing that really hard, dude.
Yes. And, you know, Angela must not have been, you know, maybe it was just a really bad case of cold feet. I don't know. But
she did not seem upset at all. Like, she was like kind of, she was a little bit upset, like, about, you know, him dying, because she was at least in the room. She's like, maybe this is for the best.
Well, and then wasn't it like maybe an episode or two later in Shore Leave where she's with like another dude on the planet surface, and then she gets shot by like a plane dive bombing them? I mean,
Shore Leave is the very next episode.
Poor Angela Martin. I mean, there has got to be, someone's got to do like some sort of like mini episode where she is just totally explained, because, wow, no wonder why they get ship's counselors eventually.
No doubt, no doubt. I mean, like, it's just very... I mean, like, Kirk seems more upset by his death than she does.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And then the music that's playing is, like, the sexy... It's like the TOS sexy music. It's, like, the sexy time music. So I'm like, oh, is he gonna, like, seduce her to make her feel better? She's like, no, I'm fine.
Very early days of Star Trek. They hadn't yet... Well, and again, the whole thing with... And I mentioned this earlier when they were scoring these episodes, he still had not seen any of these episodes. So it's sort of like, it makes you wonder, you know, these themes that now we, you know, take for granted and we know, you know, every time we hear it. At the time, it wasn't assigned, you know.
I feel like that was a piece of music from The Cage, though, like some of the sexy music. Not the first time you see the green girl, but like other times where it's just kind of them together.
So you're saying that he really just dialed it in when he scored that last scene.
I don't know. I mean, it just was like, oh, that's kind of weird. Like, yeah. it wasn't sad music. It was like
the precedent that we had already learned that the music meant wasn't really being played out in front of us.
Which... No. It was like, oh, that's sexy time music. Why is it he going to see like a console of someone in mourning with sexy time?
Don't worry, Angela. In the next episode, you're going to find a new man and all will be well until you get shot by an airplane.
That right. Was there to entertain you. I hope those bullets were very entertaining.
Well, and then I guess if you really want to push it all the way, like, she comes back, of course, in the last episode, that same actress. Remember, she's the communications officer.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But they don't call her Angela Martine. She has a different name. So maybe she eventually does get married. And, you know, she changes the color of her hair and all is made well again in the world. So
it is made well. But a minute ago, you were talking about how she... No, but how like Kirk offered the, you know, to beam them out, and like, you know, it made me think of the Star Trek reboot where he is with Romulans and he's offering to beam them out as their ship is getting sucked into a black hole, and the Romulan refuses.
Yeah, and again, I think it's back to that sort of honorable death that Romulans perceive as probably better than being disgraced by losing a ship and captured and returned home.
I don't think Nero was that though.
No.
Looking at the episode and thinking of that scene side by side, it's like maybe they tried to like, you know, adopt it a little bit since they were both Romulans, but like Nero was not on it. He was just like vengeance filled rage monster. So Kirk was counting on him to say no, so he just, you know, helped the explosions with his own torpedoes and phasers.
Well, and for Terror, they filmed. But they, you know, they cut it out, of course. But they filmed, I think, a scene of Kirk saluting the Romulan commander. If it wasn't filmed, it was definitely in the script that was cut out. But I mean, so again, you're right that there is. I don't know that we really see much of that again, where it's like, you know, the offer to surrender and we'll bring you out of there. I think Khan with the Reliant. I mean, wasn't Uhura signaling for them to surrender or something like that? So yeah, I mean, we would see that again, but
a little bit. But like, it was just very like, you know, it was Kirk and a Romulan, and he was offering like, you know, peace. It's like, look, we've been fighting, but we're better than this. Come on, we can help you, which I thought was a great mention. And it, you know, people say JJ Trek isn't real Star Trek. I'm like, look, there. I mean, it may not be what you like, but there's nuggets here and there, everywhere.
Right, and you know, it's different. It's another interpretation, and you know, it has the luxury of being able to say that it's in this other universe, you know, or timeline, whatever they're called, the Kelvin timeline. But you know, we'll see what the new series brings about, because what will really be very interesting is if, you know, it is different than any of the other two that we've seen, you know, universes or timelines, and it really diverges into something else, because then you're really going to find, I think, the audience wondering, like, wait a minute, like if JJ isn't my Trek, and now this isn't my Trek. What is my Trek? Oh, wait, the 700 and something hours of what we'd already had. So, you know, we'll see. It's very interesting time. 50th anniversary, you know, everyone's celebrating this, you know, phenomenon, this, you know, piece of Americana. And it's got a future still that is very bright, which is really cool. I mean, it's just, I can remember the 25th anniversary thinking, wow, this has been around for so long. And there's so much going on, trading cards, video games, a new series left and right, movies, and now here we are, And yes, there was a lull. I think there kind of had to be. But here we are now, 50 years later.
50 years, and we're building back up to hopefully something good. I mean, they've greenlit and signed, Hemsworth for Star Trek IV, even though unfortunately Star Trek Beyond isn't doing so hot in the movie theaters.
You know, though, I think that they need to assess that whole concept of like summer blockbuster, because it's not, let's face it, movies in general are not what they used to be. I mean, when you've got the option to stream, into your home very soon after release, or, something's on Netflix and, or the rest, to me, people aren't racing to movies like they used to. And I think that it's just a different time. And the cost.
Yes and no. I mean, like comic book, I mean, like Suicide Squad, like it's got panned by reviews, and it's doing like it broke records its first weekend, and like breaking records probably means it's made more than Star Trek in its first weekend than Star Trek's made on its entire run so far. So I mean, in a way, I mean, maybe people aren't going to see, but other people are seeing the same movie like four or five times in the weekend, like these comic book movies. And I love comic book movies, but it's just a shame. I just find it a shame that Star Trek, I mean, I was hoping at least with Justin Lin's name attached to it in Fast and the Furious, I was hoping his name would pull that Fast and Furious crowd to Star Trek and let us see, bigger box office returns. And it looks like it's going to make its money back, if it hasn't already, by the time we recorded this. I haven't checked it in a couple days. But last time I checked it was just shy of making its, reported budget back. And usually they want, 1.5 to 2 times the cost of the film for it to be financially successful.
Right. Well, and I mean, has the international poll been considered as well? Because I know...
Oh, yeah, I was looking at the international one.
Okay, yeah, I was going to say, because I know with the previous outings, I am pretty confident that the international sort of profits were just enough to make it sort of a juggernaut again. But, I think we'll see a fourth movie. I'd be really surprised if, they turn around and backtracked and said, never mind, and two, with the new series, that I think will dictate a lot of what we're going to see as well, because that's obviously an on-demand type, it's a subscription service. So it's not like you can just turn on and watch. I mean, the pilot, I think they will be airing on just CBS, but then for the rest, I'm sure I'm talking to a lot of people out there who will pay for it, because I know I will. It's new Trek. So, that we'll see how that does as well. It unfortunately does come down to the money, and I don't know that I've ever seen Star Trek really, really, really disappoint. Maybe Star Trek V, but otherwise.
Well, thanks to the magic of the internet, I'm looking at Box Office Mojo. The movie cost, the production budget was $185 million, and worldwide it's made $195. So we're $10 million above its budget. So it's like just made money. Just starting to barely make money worldwide, as of right now. But they've already said they're making it. I mean, they've cast Hemsworth already. So,
right.
I mean, it sounds like it's a sure deal. I think I saw another article that says it doesn't matter if this movie makes money or not. They're still making another one. So maybe they'll just cut the budget and do more story-focused Star Trek. I don't know.
It'll be interesting to find out how they're going to bring back Chris Hemsworth, especially given that, at least in my opinion, physically, he doesn't really look the same anymore. I mean, he's now Thor and not so much, George Kirk.
Well,
so.
But I mean, if you see him and if you saw him in Ghostbusters, he looks a lot more like George Kirk than he does. I mean, Thor, he looks very different as Thor because of A, long hair, and B, facial hair.
Sure.
When he's a clean shaven, he still looks very much like, and short hair and clean shaven, he still looks kind of, maybe a little bit more buffer than he was in Star Trek 2009, but
I didn't go down with the Kelvin. I've been at the gym ever since, Jim.
I got sucked into a black hole. I've just been pumping weights.
Yes, so I've been working out the whole time. There's been nothing else to do.
Well, crashing the Kelvin, made Odin smile upon me. So he drew me up to...
Perfect.
As I was flying out of the view screen, he pulled me up to Valhalla. And he gave me the hammer and made me Thor.
We've just uncovered the crossover. That's what the one's doing. That's it. Oh, my goodness.
But, they're saying they're bringing back the original authors of the original Star Trek Beyond script, which was, two people who were partnering with Orsi. I'm not sure if Orsi has been brought back on. Mm-hmm. But that script, you know, original early rumors reported that there was going to be a female captain who kind of was like going to match wits with Kirk and or like, you know, be a love interest to Kirk. There was also a rumor that Shatner and Nimoy were going to be in it. Unfortunately, Nimoy won't be able to be in it unless they like digitally resurrect him.
Which I hope they honestly don't do. I mean, I'm not a huge fan of that, but yeah.
But I mean, like the original script, they were saying they were calling for like, you know, older versions of Kirk and Spock to be in it. That was the rumors of Star Trek Beyond before Simon Pegg and Doug Jung took over the writing of the film. So this is what we were hearing, and like none of these things happened. So and then maybe Hemsworth is just another part of the time travel. Maybe old Kirk, young Kirk, and Kirk's dad somehow all being together. Or maybe you get a look into the other timeline where you do see like old Kirk and. I don't know what they're writing. I'm just like speculating.
Maybe George Kirk ends up back in the Prime universe, and I mean, wouldn't that be pretty slick if he comes out on the other end and is sort of in the future of, you know, in the Prime universe? I mean, that then would give opportunities for tie in with the series. I mean, yeah, maybe.
I mean, who knows what they're doing and writing?
Yeah.
It just seems like they're now going back to the original Star Trek Beyond script that may have been tweaked between then and now to bring back Hemsworth. So I mean I'm excited to see what they're going to do with it. I just hope it involves Klingons too, because as much as I love the new movies and how great they've been and how beautiful they look, Klingons have been wearing stupid helmets and we haven't seen their faces and we haven't really seen them be awesome. We haven't seen any of their cruisers except for in the training simulator for Kobayashi Maru. So I really want to see that. And speaking of, you know, tying back into this episode, Balance of Terror, we have not yet seen this kind of Kirk in the Kelvin timeline, the calculating, like, ship tactician.
No, I agree. I agree with that. And that is something that if you mix the two, I mean, you're already talking about a great movie opportunity right there. I mean, and maybe that is something that we will see. I mean,
but I
love Klingons especially, you're right. I think in the new movies, they have been sort of
underplayed,
or maybe they're saving them for something far greater. I mean, again, it's this different universe. So we have no idea what the likes of Kang, Kor, and Koloth are doing right now. You know, I mean, so you've got such opportunities, you know, basically, you know, almost clean slate. And yeah, that would be maybe really cool opportunity there.
I'd love to see actual Klingon characters instead of just like throwaway Klingon red shirts. I'd love to see some actual Klingon characters with some lines and some story and some something in the JJ universe with the Klingons, because they're like the number one race. And as much as I love Star Trek Beyond, Star Trek in the Darkness, they're like, the Klingon War is coming! The Klingon War is coming! The Klingon War is coming! And like, this movie has nothing to do with Klingons at all. So I'm like, I loved it. It was great, but I'm like, where's the Klingon War? Like, you know, war is imminent. You know, I just really wanted to see something with the Klingons. Hopefully for Star Trek 4, crossing my fingers.
With Chris Hemsworth, yes.
Chris Hemsworth takes on the Klingons.
Well, I mean, wait, so they did have Klingons central to arriving at the destruction point of the Kelvin, right?
I mean, yeah, the Klingons found they were on the edge. I think the Narada was disabled by the Kelvin near the edge of the Klingon neutral zone. The Klingons collected the ship and put the Romulans in Rorapente, and they escape from Rorapente, take their ship back, and get back just in time for Spock to come through the wormhole.
So
20-something years later.
You've got a lot of things that happen there that we may not have seen, you know? I mean, between the different timelines, you know, there's some interplay there. The Klingons are certainly present, you know? So who knows? I mean, that definitely could lead to exactly what you're talking about, which is a far more prominent role for the Klingons in the next role. And there's also this war that was sort of mentioned in Into Darkness. So yeah, we'll see when, and more details are coming, I'm sure. I'm honestly surprised that they released already, you know, not only the fact that there was going to be a fourth movie, or at least the indication that they had signed somebody. I mean, it's so early for that kind of thing. I was, you know, really surprised, but you know, it is the 50th anniversary, so I suppose we should.
Maybe we won't have to wait 5 years for this movie. Maybe they'll
right. right.
Maybe exactly. they'll get it done quick. Cause I mean, like between Star Trek and Star Trek in the Darkness is like 6 or 7. It was a really long time.
Well, and I think, too, they'll want to see how the series does, and they'll launch that first. But, you know, you're right. I mean, if that's, like, you know, a huge success, a movie would probably be soon to follow. And, again, that's to me where it's like, do they then start talking about intertwining them somehow?
Well, that's what people might be thinking. Like, they're trying to figure out if, like, maybe the fourth Star Trek movie will, because they're casting Hemsworth, are they going to, like, collapse the Kelvin timeline back into the Prime timeline somehow?
That would be an interesting thought. I mean...
There's always the Guardian of Forever. I mean, that seems like a really easy fix if they wanted to do
it. Absolutely. I mean, there are so many different things that could have fixed the predicament that I guess the Kelvin timeline kind of forms. It's interesting that nobody really, namely Prime Spock, sought to correct everything in the process. But I mean, then we wouldn't have the new sort of movie. So.
Yeah.
I guess I understand it, but you're right. There are so many opportunities. Q, I mean, where's Q? He, I'm sure, could play around with all of this if he had the chance. But
oh,
you know.
That would be beautiful. I'd love to see Q.
Right.
Get John DeLancey in there right now. I love John DeLancey.
I'm sure he would be up for it. I'm sure he'd love it.
I mean, he does voice work for Star Trek Timeline, so.
Right. Yep.
He's still got his fingers in Star Trek, which is fantastic because I love him, and I'm sad he was only in one DS9 episode.
Well, the thing that I know people always comment on, which I agree with, but then I also, you know, I'm a huge fan. So, you know, it's painful to hear when people say, oh, well, they're too old now to be a character. So, like, of course, Brent Spiner is Data. The likelihood of seeing that again is very unlikely because he looks nothing like Data anymore.
It doesn't matter. They can digitally de-age him, just like they did with, was it Robert Redford or whoever it was in one of the Marvel movies? Like, they made him look like, or Michael Douglas.
Well, or if, you know, they recast the role, you know, and again, I know a lot of people balk at that, but I mean, think about it. Q looked a certain way for an amount of time, but I mean, he's a Q. Does he look like anything? He just sort of took a form, so he could easily take the form of anybody else and then just suddenly be like, yep, now I'm Q. And I think that would be fair play, you know, and it's absolutely not a disservice to John DeLancey at all. But if they were looking for ways to bring a character back,
it could still even be John DeLancey. Just maybe the earlier in the timeline you see John DeLancey's Q, the older he looks, and the later he looks younger.
You're not taking me very seriously, young Jim Kirk. So I'm going to make myself look older and wiser. So now you'll start to listen to me. Hey,
exactly. They could digitally de-age him so that he looks exactly like he did Next Gen. And then he's like, you're not taking me seriously. So he like switches, flicks his fingers, and then they don't have to put the young age CGI on him. And then he can just be – that would be awesome.
You know what? And it's all wide open right now. The only thing that we know with even the slightest certainty is that there will at a minimum be some background character or a main character with antennae, which is – awesome. we'll find out what it is soon enough.
Most definitely. I'm hoping we'll see like a trailer soon-ish. I mean, there's still a bunch of Star Trek conventions happening this year because of the 50th.
Right.
There's one in New York in like September, I think. So maybe by then there'll actually be a trailer. Maybe one of the non-Vegas Star Trek events will actually get some Star Trek Beyond news because... I mean, not Beyond news, Star Trek Discovery news. Mm-hmm. Just because, well... it's the first time it's out, so why not show it at a Star Trek convention?
I think we may start to see, I'm really hoping for casting news sometime soon.
I want Gillian Anderson to be the captain.
I think you mentioned that to me before, and, you know, I'm looking at it through the lens of I'm really curious to see what they're going to bring in. Because it kind of, you know, what they alluded to. So it does seem like, I think someone had mentioned Angela Bassett. Maybe it was Brian Fuller himself.
It was Brian Fuller that mentioned Angela Bassett, but yeah. Angela Bassett herself shot that rumor down like as soon as they mentioned her, as soon as the series was announced, because that was one of his, like, you know, pipe dreams back when it was from an old interview from even before Star Trek Discovery was going to be a thing. he was just like, man, if I got to do my own, I'd love to cast Angela Bassett, and, you know.
But, I mean, let's face it, she's not, I mean, if that's really the type of captain, at least, and, you know, we have no idea what the backstory would be, but, like, visually, and at least what we know of Angela Bassett, there are other actresses that could meet that, if not exceed, you know, and make the role her own. So, you know, we'll see. I mean, sure. I'm trying not to, it's so easy to fall into like, this is my dream cast, you know, and got, you know, all the names and everything, but I'm just so excited to, you know, hear casting news, hear a little bit more about the timeline, you know, at least in the first season, is there an opportunity that they might jump into the future or into the past? What are they going to actually do? Is Section 31 involved? You know, the ship design, is that changing much? You know, so it's just all in front of us. And this is the time that's the most exciting because it's all speculation. It's all excitement generating. It's just a great time to be a fan, really.
Yeah, it definitely is. I mean, I don't really have a full, like, you know, dream cast. I mean, I'd love to see a bunch of the Firefly actors get, like, roles in it, or, like, some of the people in geekdom who are big in geekdom to have a role in it. But mostly, the only firm one I really have is Gillian Anderson, and even more so now that, you know, the rumor of Section 31 being a thing, because, you know, she's, like, in the, you know, Scully and the X-Files. It'd be kind of fun. It'd be kind of fun to have, like, her as, like, a Section 31 captain, because she's, like, into the conspiracy type stuff.
Not too much of a stretch for her as an actress, perhaps.
Not at all. And the thing is, like, she's got this older, mature look to her. Like, she would be a really ideal female captain, I think. And
yeah,
she's got really good gravitas, and she's not, and she can be very serious and very, you know, commanding of presence, but she's also got more of a feminine side to her, I guess. Like, where Janeway, she just kind of felt really mannish most of the time.
Oh my goodness!
It's not Kate Mulgrew. It's the way they wrote her character, I think.
Well, right. The writing certainly did not, and Kate Mulgrew would, I think, agree with this to some extent. You know, and she fought very hard to get more sort of femininity in her role, and fortunately for, I think, most people, she was successful in doing so. But I think that, you know, when you're talking about a captain today, you know, another thing that they keep talking about, Brian Fuller, you know, and the rest of the production staff, is this whole notion of, you know, gender not being an issue, and they've dropped homosexuality a few times. So, you know, I think it's going to be really interesting to see, you know, they haven't given much information, but that little information that they've given, what does this actually translate then into, you know, cast and in the writing? And is that going to actually be something? Is it going to be alien? Is it going to be, you know, a human being that just is sort of this way?
I just can't see an alien captain.
I mean, even in, like, the crew. I mean, yeah.
I'm sure there's got to be some alien crew member. I just can't see an alien captain. I would like to see an alien captain. I just don't think it's actually going to happen.
Well, and I think, too, he dropped the hint that there would be multiple crews, you know, so perhaps we will see a captain that is an alien.
That would be cool.
That's genderless. I mean, who knows? At this point, you know, again, the very little info that they've given, it's easy to kind of go off and, you know, the imagination runs wild. But that's the exciting part about waiting for the new series. And I know that they are loving the fact that we are all going crazy like this. But
speculating.
Yes, and exactly.
I think also Gillian Anderson could pull off being a female Kirk.
Let's see. Does that mean that she's going to be kissing guys every planet she drops off at? I mean, I don't know. Again, I don't know how she'd feel about that as an actress, but, you know, we'll see. I guess we'll see. Again, I had nothing against her at all. It'd be interesting to see her in the role, or at least have a role. You know, one guy I had mentioned before that I thought was hugely underrated in Battlestar Galactica was Tom O'Pennicott, the Hilo character. And his character was meant to be this sort of throwaway character in the pilot, and they liked him so much. And he has become sort of a, I don't want to say like a science fiction icon, but he's certainly known, I think, a little bit more
He does pop up a lot.
So I was thinking, you know, maybe someone like him would be a sort of familiar but welcome, you know, who knows? We'll see. And it is filming in Toronto, which is an hour away from us. So hopefully we'll be able to take a ride up at some point and see stuff going on with the series.
That would be fun.
Yep.
I mean, like, I like him, but I just don't know if, like, I could see him as a leading man.
We'd have to see. I mean, I think a lot of that, obviously.
I think he's a really good supporting character, like a second to main character, because he was kind of like a pseudo side main character in Dollhouse.
I feel like, though, if he were, you know, I feel like with Anderson and with him as, like, the XO, now you're really talking Janeway and Chakotay done again. And I mean, obviously different names and everything, but it would look so close to that. It would be like, oh, no, they shouldn't probably do this. So we'll see.
Wait, you know, maybe we'll get a female XO. That would be cool.
Yeah, it would. Yeah, it would. I mean, Kira Norris, you know, I remember being a kid thinking, she's Bajoran and she's the first officer. How does that work? And initially, all, you know, the whole religious thing. And I thought, I'm not so sure about this, but geez, you know, when it came to an effective XO that could really kick ass, I mean, Kira Norris, I was like a big fan by the time that DS9 ended.
Oh, yeah. I really think she comes into her prime around season 7, though, because she's kind of like a hard ass in a bad way for the first, like, 5 seasons, and then she gets with Odo, and then I feel like Odo mellows her out a little bit.
Literally.
Yeah, and then I really think she's, like, almost a different character in season 7, and she's so much more likable because she's less, like, angry all the time.
I agree. Yeah, I mean, and she's just one of the many female characters that, you know, it would be interesting to take any number of them and put them in an XO role and see how they kind of, you know, if it makes sense to have them modeled after. I mean, it's going to be really cool one way or another to have them explain, you know, this is the cast and these are their roles and, you know, what will they be doing? You know, so I'm excited. It's, and hopefully we do hear more soon.
It's definitely very exciting times. Mm-hmm. I forgot to mention this at the beginning. It's really hot today and I'm recording before I go to work. I just got a new job, guys. So if there's fan noises, I apologize. Also, Faith couldn't make it because we were just trying to get our schedules matched up because we used to record at night. Now we're having to record during the day, so we just got to take a little bit to get our schedules matched up. So it might be some chaos going on for a little bit right now. But Jeff, thank you so much for coming on and recording with me today, talking about Balance of Terror. It's been a fantastic time.
This was so much fun and really appreciate it. Finally, glad to be here. And yeah, hopefully I'll be able to do it again.
Oh, yeah, maybe if we just, like we got into our Starship discussion earlier, maybe we can get, you know, Guy and Faith on with us. Maybe we can get all of us together and just talk Starships for like an entire episode. That would be kind of fun.
Yes, and easily done because the opinions would start.
I think we took up the first 30 minutes talking about Starships.
Right, exactly. But no, thank you. And thanks again for having me. Thanks, everybody, for listening. It's great to be a part of this, of course. Thanks.
Oh, for sure. Thank you so much again for coming. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Live long and prosper. All our music is provided by Warp 11. You can find them at warp11.com or at Warp 11 on Twitter. You can find me at David_J_Duncan. You can find the show at Synthaholic Duo. You can find Faith at Faith Hertzberg, Aaron O'Brien at Blackbird 2004, Guy Davis at GS Davis Art, I believe, and USS Tamerlan on Twitter. You can email us at Synthaholics@yahoo.com. We love your emails. We love to read them on the air. Please send them our way so we can do so. We love fan interaction, listener interaction, so we can go ahead and do that and get your voices heard. If you have questions, if you have comments about previous episodes, send them our way. We'll read them, and we'll give you our thoughts and answer your questions to the best of our ability. Please go and rate and review us on iTunes or Stitcher or the Google Play Store. More ratings and reviews will get us more viewers because we become more visible in the charts. So please get out there and write some reviews for us. If you love the show and you think it's worth sending some money to, check out patreon.com/synthaholics if you want to support the show. If you're interested in Guy Davis's art, his USS Tamerlan comic, and his upcoming Witches of Flame, you can check out patreon.com/gsdavisart. Thank you all so much for listening. Live long and prosper. The night's over, I'll puke in the sink, and we'll cry till we laugh, and we'll both shit our pants. You're the best drinking friend I ever had. Cool.
Is it done?
Yeah.
Awesome. That was so much fun.
I'm glad you enjoyed it.
I have never done anything quite like that, so that is sort of like, oh my goodness.